This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The Science Notes podcast on ORFM Dunedin, brought to you by the Division of Sciences at the University of Otago. I'm Dave McMorran. Over the next half hour, I'll be chatting with a graduate science student about their research, their passion for science, and the things that fuel their creativity. Well, hello there, and welcome to another episode of Science Notes. My name's Dave McMorran, and this time, my guest is Andrew Wilson. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming along on a remarkably sunny Dunedin morning. But then it is December, so it should be, really. Andrew is doing a PhD in chemistry at Otago. We haven't had a chemist in for a little while, it seems like, so that's good. And so we're going to be talking a bit tonight about today, whenever you're listening, about what he's been doing for his research. You're what, a year in?
Yeah,
a bit over.
It would be probably 9 months in now.
9 months in, yeah. I see you're still kind of fresh and new and everything's still going to work and it's wonderful.
We hope.
You're doing a PhD in quite an interesting area, and it's quite a new area for the department, yeah. I suppose, because you're working with a guy, Yanfeng, yes. Who's quite new to the department.
Yeah. So Yanfeng started, would have been November of last year.
Right. So you're his first PhD student.
Yeah, his first PhD student.
Exciting.
Yeah.
And the work that you're doing is chemistry, but it's also biology as well. It's quite a strong, I mean, there's quite a lot of crossover and lots of aspects of what we do in the department, but yours in particular is a very clear crossover. So we're going to talk about that, but before we get into that, how is it that, how do you find yourself doing a PhD in sort of chemistry?
So I started really enjoying science, especially in high school. When I got into science in like year 12, I had a really cool chemistry teacher called Mr. Drury.
Right.
He wasn't actually a chemist, but I thought he was really, really cool.
So where was this?
This was at Kavanagh, which is now
Trinity. Oh, right, in Dunedin. Yeah.
So I really got into chemistry from him and then kind of decided when I got to uni, I was like, okay, I'll study chemistry. I was also really interested in math at the time.
Yeah.
And then so started doing a double major in chem and math. Dropped the math pretty quickly to a minor once I got to second year. That was a time.
Yeah.
But then, ended up going through with a major in chemistry and then really, really enjoyed building sensors. I tried to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I had done my third year project with Christina McGraw doing iron selective electrodes. And so then I stuck around with her for a summer project and then did my honors with her building a fluorescent microscopic setup to detect lipids in microalgae.
Right.
And then that all wrapped up last year. And so, okay, what's next? I thought about heading overseas and then realized I really enjoyed Dunedin.
Mm.
Wasn't ready to leave home yet.
Yep. Sounds like me a lot, actually.
And then during my honors, I had the chance to interview Yanfeng and a couple of other candidates for the new electrochemist role at Otago.
Right. Yep.
And that's where I kind of found out a lot about biosensors. And that's kind of how I got to where I am today. Had a lot of chats with him, realized I really was interested in his research, and decided to start a PhD with him, jump into the deep end, and now we're here.
Yeah. And it's kind of fun, I suppose, because you're, to an extent, you're kind of helping him get established and set up here.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a team of getting the research up and going.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you've said that you're doing biosensors, mm-hmm. and we're going to absolutely come back to that, but what are you sensing?
So,
sensors are a tool for analyzing
a
particular thing. What is it that you're interested in?
So we can analyze a lot of stuff that our body excretes, and it tells us a lot about how our body's feeling. I like to think about it when you go to the bathroom and you see that your urine's not looking as clear as it could be, maybe you need to drink some more water. But we can also do it for anything that comes out of the body, including breath.
Yeah.
And breath-based biosensors are really interesting at the moment because they're a really non-invasive method, which we definitely don't have as much of in the current space for sensing materials.
I mean, that said, of course, I suppose the biosensor that people are most familiar with perhaps is breathalyzer tests, which is exactly what you're talking about. It's looking for the presence of ethanol on your breath.
Yeah.
by blowing into a thing. So that's the sort of thing we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we are trying to use our breath-based sensors to detect diseases. Most interestingly, we're trying to do it for Alzheimer's, which seems kind of weird. It's not really a breath-based disease with lung cancers. Kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
It's happening in the lungs. But there have been a couple of papers recently that have shown this relation of biomarkers in breath to the severity of Alzheimer's in patients. And so Jan Frank and I are quite interested in seeing, can we actually build a sensor that selectively detects these biomarkers?
As a way to diagnose Alzheimer's.
Yeah, try and get this early diagnosis. Whilst it also being really accessible, breath-based sensors tend to be quite portable and quite cheap to make. So then you can get them to these more rural areas without having to worry about like it being expensive or it being unfair.
Like an MRI or something where you have to go to some big city and then wait for 6 months to get in the queue, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and of course Alzheimer's is increasingly a thing.
Yes.
There'll be a market for this.
Yep. So Alzheimer's, the kind of statistics between Alzheimer's and dementia are kind of intertwined. About 80% of all dementia patients have Alzheimer's or get there through Alzheimer's. In 2019, there was 55 million cases of dementia. By 2050, we expect it to go up to 150 million.
Which is worldwide.
Worldwide.
Yeah.
And it's disproportionately targeting developing regions where we don't have that diagnostic tool.
Yeah.
So there is absolutely a need for it.
Although that said, presumably in developing regions, the number of people with it who are actually diagnosed with it is
exactly
less.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it's probably worse.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what sorts of things then are people breathing out if they have Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. It's less of what they're breathing out, but it's more what they're not breathing out.
Right, okay.
So there's a negative correlation between pyrrole and benzene with Alzheimer's progression.
Right.
So there was a study that was published earlier this year where they showed a negative correlation between pyrrole and this compound called p-tau, which is this phosphorylated tau protein, which is one of the more classic biomarkers that you can find in your brain, but also can find in people's blood nowadays.
Right. This is one of these plaque things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's like the amyloid beta plaques and there's these like tau tangles. So yeah, they showed a negative correlation with blood concentration of p-tau for pyrrole, and then they also showed a negative correlation between benzene and what we call the clinical dementia rating, which is kind of like how far progressed is your Alzheimer's on like a numerical system.
Is that just simply because, I mean, maybe people don't know, is that simply because you're keeping these molecules in and that's helping make you sick? Or is it a more subtle change in the metabolism that's going on?
I think it's a more subtle change in the metabolism. It's not very clear the metabolic pathways for this. Still pretty new in the field, so it's kind of hard to say right now.
I think it's interesting that people who are studying Alzheimer's are measuring what's not in people's breath in their patients. In the first place, that doesn't seem an obvious thing to do. But
it definitely makes challenges for building a sensor for it.
Yes.
Because instead of having to look this really, really small concentration, you need to look this really, really small change in concentration, which causes a lot of problems when it comes to getting your materials right.
So I suppose that nicely leads into the sensor design thing. So a sensor then, I suppose from a chemistry perspective, for you, what is a sensor?
So a sensor is something that can tell us, essentially something that tells us the concentration of something else. So if you think of a breathalyzer, it's what's the concentration of ethanol in your breath?
These little things that you have for your on your phone increasingly now, where you can measure insulin levels and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's measuring how much of that there is in your bloodstream and what have you.
Yeah.
How do they work? Because you've already kind of indicated that we can measure quite low concentrations of things now. So they're very sensitive, but how? Yeah. I mean, how do they work?
So it depends. It changes from sensor to sensor. I'm working with electrochemical sensors, so the way they kind of work is your molecule comes close to the electrode interface and then you get some reduction or oxidation of that compound at a set voltage, and then you can see a current either increase or decrease based on if it's an oxidation or a reduction event. This can then be, you kind of have this electrochemical signal. This can then go through like a transducer, which then can give you an actual like numerical output, being like, oh, here's your concentration.
And so if you so like for the benzene, the benzene will undergo this electrochemical process at a particular voltage, and so you can focus in on that and see whether the amount of electrochemistry that's happening is less than you expect it to be.
Yes. So the idea is that we know how much benzene there should be in someone's breath.
Yep.
It's at the low ppb range. And so if we have someone with like quite acute Alzheimer's, we would see that quite dramatic change. But someone who's really early on, it would be a pretty minute difference. So then we would have to check it over time to be able to say, oh, this is something you might actually want to get checked out.
Right. So I suppose this is going to be part of it as well, is that it's presumably other things that cause decreases in benzene concentration in your breath.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of understanding what those changes would look like in an Alzheimer's patient at different points along the progression of the disease, but also try and understand all the other things that could be leading to that decrease as well. So
That's one of the advantages of testing for different multiple biomarkers.
Yes.
We kind of build this like nose up.
Yeah.
And then we can be like, okay, this is showing it, but so is Peril, so is BHT, so is XYZ.
Mm.
Like, this is giving us a really clear sign there might be something going on.
Mm. In that way, it's actually quite similar to the way that your nose works.
Yeah.
Because when you smell things, as I understand it, it's not just one molecule causing, making you think, oh, that smells like vanilla.
Mm.
It's actually multiple molecules, and it's a combination of all of those that are telling your brain that's what the smell is.
This is this idea of an electronic nose has been a big thing in the last, decade or so because of exactly that. It's more than one thing that gives us that signal.
Yeah.
We need multiple things.
So the sensor then,
mm-hmm.
So you're building the sensors from scratch.
Yeah.
And in your notes, you said that you're using something called an ionic liquid as a part of that. So tell us what an ionic liquid is and how it's different to a normal liquid, perhaps.
Yeah.
We'll see if you remember from when I taught you this in first year.
So ionic liquids, I like to think of being ionic solids, but they're just a bit more annoying. So we know with ionic solids, they've got these repeating units of positive and negative charges. If you think of like sodium chloride, so that's sodium cation and that chloride anion. And they've got really nice strong ionic bonds, and so they form this really nice lattice, a nice crystalline solid. With ionic liquids, same kind of idea. We still have these cations and anions next to each other, but the anions and cations are a little bit bigger, they're a little bit more diffuse, and so that ionic bond is a lot weaker. And so we see instead of them having these strong ionic bonds, they're a little bit weaker, a little bit less stable, and so we now have these things filled with ions that are like a liquid at room temperature.
Yeah.
Some of them are room temperature ionic liquids. Some of them are a little bit higher. There's no real limit to where they turn from an ionic liquid to being a not ionic liquid. It used to be like 100 degrees was the limit, but now people are using like 200 degrees. It's really whatever you need for the system.
Yes, it's getting close to just being a normal old ionic compound that you've melted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an ionic compound that can at least melt.
Yeah.
It's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah. And these themselves are relatively new.
Yeah.
They weren't a thing when I was a student.
No. So they were first discovered a really long time ago, back in 1916, I think.
Mm.
But it was only really up until the 90s was where they really started becoming a thing, when people realized you could use these like imidazolium kind of cations.
Yeah.
And that really blew the field up. So over the last 30 years, there has been a massive range of ionic liquids formed. I think papers are now claiming up to 10 to the 18 different kinds of combinations of alkyl chains and cations and anions.
Yeah, yeah. Because they're made up of two components and you can change their two components.
Yeah.
You can get very quickly multiple different combinations of them that you can try, and they all have their own properties.
Yep.
And most of the time they're just being used like solvents,
like
you would use water to dissolve things, and you dissolve things in these, but they've got these weird interesting properties.
Yeah. So a lot of the time you can use them just as like a solvent or for catalysis, or a lot of people have been using them for like biomass purification or formation of biogas or syngas. But you can use them really interesting as a sensing platform.
Mm.
Because of all these cations and anions, for electrochemistry you no longer need a supporting electrolyte, and your charges are way more concentrated.
Okay. So like in a battery you have all these, you have the electrodes, the metal bits, or the carbon. And then you have all these other things in there to facilitate the flow of the electrons and make the current.
Yeah.
Here, the solvent's doing that job already.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so this means when you have, say in our case, benzene or pyrrole or BHT, when it undergoes that redox process, we get a much more sensitive signal because of the ionic liquid being able to do its job.
So that means you can measure much smaller concentration differences.
Exactly.
Right. So what is the ionic liquid that you're using?
So,
or was it all secret squirrels?
We're trying to figure that out at the moment.
Yeah.
So all three of our biomarkers, benzene, pyrrole, and BHT. BHT is this like butylated hydroxytoluene, so it's like a benzene with a bunch of carbons coming off it and then an OH group. They're all aromatic. And so if we're trying to get this really selective sensor, we want to have this really good solubility for our compounds. One idea that we've come up with is if we use ionic liquids that are inherently aromatic as well, so things like thimidazoleums, things like pyridiniums, we might be able to get some really favorable pi-pi stacking between our cations and our target molecules, getting some really good sensitivity there.
For those of us in the game, the idea of trying to dissolve an aromatic thing like benzene in an ionic liquid seems like fundamentally it shouldn't work, because that doesn't really, because to dissolve, you need to have the thing you're dissolving want to be able to favorably interact with the solvent, and ionic things and aromatic things shouldn't. But obviously, ionic liquids are interesting in all sorts of ways, and this is one of those ways.
Yeah. There's a really interesting phenomenon that occurs with depending on how long your carbon chain is in your ionic liquid. You get what we call these microstructures, where there are like areas of ionic charge and areas of nonpolar charge.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, you can get the benzene into the nonpolar charge.
Yeah.
As it moves around, it might be able to just quite happily just jump into the ionic part for a second, redox.
So it's almost like a really, really runny membrane.
Yeah.
Interesting. Cool. And of course, a sign that ionic liquids are a thing is that you've just come back from a conference on ionic liquids.
Yes. So I spent a week in Perth at Coil 10, where there's a lot of research about the uses of ionic liquids. One of the chairs of the conference, Debbie Sylvester-Dean, she spent a lot of time researching this kind of electrochemical gas sensor, but for explosives.
Right.
For the mining industry over in Perth. And it was kind of what got us into this field, as we saw her give a talk at NZIC last year in Dunedin.
Right, yeah.
And that was kind of like the lighting of the fire. But yeah, lots of really interesting stuff in Perth. Lots of peacocks. first day I arrived, I arrived on the wrong side of campus at UWA. Had to walk all the way through campus. As soon as I got to like the conference hall, there was just a white peacock standing outside it. And it became a thing where it was like, whoever got the best peacock photo won a prize.
There you go.
It was fantastic.
Yes, it was like I remember the first time I went to Brisbane for a conference, the campus there's awash with these huge lizards. And you go, yeah, we're not in New Zealand anymore.
No.
So the sensors then. So part of the research, so the sensors are going to be based on this ionic liquid. They're going to be electrochemical, so there's going to be electrodes in them. Part of your job is to build these things.
Yeah.
So what do they look like? What's involved in building one of these sensors for you?
So there's kind of two ways we can think about it. We can either have the more classical, like having the electrodes sitting in the solution, and we do it that way, which is how we're currently doing it.
So kind of like a pH electrode, if people have seen one of those. Yeah.
Absolutely. Alternatively, there in electrochemistry, we also have what we call these like, I call them a surface electrode, where they're kind of like the size of your fingernail.
Yep.
And so you can put a little droplet of your ionic liquid on the sensing surface, and then you have all three electrodes essentially in this tiny space. And it gives you really, really high sensitivity, but also really portable because you're not having to deal with like these electrodes sticking into a solvent and they're not moving. You just have your like really sticky solvent on top of the electrode, nice and happy.
And so then the way it would work is that the patient would breathe onto the droplet of your ionic liquid on this little surface.
Yeah.
And then the molecules would dissolve in the liquid, move through it to the electrode where the measurement could be made.
Yeah.
And then you can quantify how much of everything is.
Yeah, it's the dream.
Yeah. And then the little electrode itself must be attached to some sort of
so you have to
computer, quote unquote, at the other end.
Yeah.
But that can all be incorporated into quite a small unit as well.
You can even connect these things to Bluetooth to your phone.
There you go.
So almost like the glucose sensors nowadays, nice and portable.
Yeah. And so this is what you're building these things, right?
Yeah, that'll be the long-term goal.
Once you work out what you've got to build.
Yeah. Once we figure out what ionically would we want to use for each electrode or for each biomarker, sorry. We'll then essentially start making these smaller electrodes and seeing, hey, can we actually get this stuff to work?
So how then are you working out what ionic liquid? I mean, presumably you want to find an ionic liquid that's best at dissolving the molecules of interest in the pyrrole and the benzene and what have you. Presumably you then have another way to measure what the concentrations are in those.
Yeah. So there are a couple of methods we're thinking about at the moment. The first one would be this like quantitative NMR. So if we can just figure out how much there is that way, easy peasy.
Yeah, again, NMR and ionic liquids seems to me as somewhat of an old chemist now to be fundamentally not going to ever work. But it does, clearly.
Yeah. Or potentially quantitative GCMS. This one's a little trickier. We know that the ionic liquid won't like boil. One of the cool things about ionic liquids is that they just don't have a vapor pressure, so they don't evaporate, which is great.
Except for when you want to get rid of them.
Exactly. That's where things get interesting. But then if we can essentially boil off our like benzene and our pyrrole and our other like confounding biomarkers, we can then say, oh, this one's really good at dissolving benzene, but is kind of worse at pyrrole.
Yeah.
This could be a really good choice.
So you have your little solution of your things, and then you leave the little solvent behind, but you evaporate out the components and then measure how much of those there are. So that's where things are at the moment then.
Yeah. So currently we're trying to essentially make all the ionic liquids we want to test, and then we want to do a bunch of electrical characterization to see, okay, this one can actually like work at the voltage we need for each compound, and then we're going to do all these solubility tests to figure out which ionic liquid is the best for each compound, but then also test to see how they respond to confounding biomarkers they can reduce.
Because that, of course, is the other thing, isn't it? Is it's one thing to just put the benzene in, but the breath is going to have thousands of compounds on it.
Yeah.
And
yes, there's about 3,000 different compounds in breath,
right.
So you need to be pretty selective. For example, in chronic lung diseases, a lot of patients have excess benzaldehyde, which oxidizes at pretty much the same potential as benzene. So trying to get an ionic liquid that would target benzene favorably is kind of tricky. One idea we had was making these really electron-withdrawn cations. So instead of just being a regular cation, having these electron-withdrawing groups on top of it, we're hoping that will like increase the pi-pi stacking towards benzene, which is electron-rich, whereas benzaldehyde is electron-deficient. Hopefully getting that higher selectivity there.
Right. So even though the two compounds in theory will respond to your electrode the same way, you can get one to the electrode preferentially to the other by the way that they interact with the with the ionic liquid.
Exactly.
Cool. So you're not even a year in. Yeah. Heaps to go yet.
Oh, yeah.
is the hope at some point to be actually going over to the med school and doing some of the biology?
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I think ethics will be fun to get approval for that, but I'm sure it won't be too bad.
It's a good experience to go through.
Absolutely.
Do you actively have collaborators over there, or not yet?
Not to my knowledge.
No.
Yanfeng may have sorted something, but...
Yeah. But I suppose, too, if you can get this working, then, you know, you're interested in doing it for Alzheimer's, but there's myriad other things that it
absolutely.
Can be used for as well, so... You could have a whole suite of these little things.
Exactly.
Did I hear that you're using 3D printing as part of making these?
Yeah. So currently we're using 3D printing in a couple of interesting ways. You can use 3D printing to make these electrodes, which has kind of gone out of style nowadays. But I'm using 3D printing almost as a way to make our electrochemical setups to get all the characterization for our materials. Because ionic liquids are kind of pain to make in high volumes, I'm using really, really small quantities for this electrochemistry. But that also means you can't just use regular glassware because glassware is a bit of a pain. So we're using Teflon instead. So we have this Teflon, it's like a Teflon bowl that we have our ionic liquid in. But because ionic liquids are really hygroscopic, they absorb water really easily, we need to have a really controlled setup to be able to actually measure our stuff.
Yeah.
So we have our Teflon inside this like 3D printed casing where then just the electrodes can get into it, and that's then surrounded by this like glass setup, which can be essentially evacuated, get all the water out of the ionic liquid, and then flooded in with argon or nitrogen to give us like a inert dry atmosphere that we can do all our measurements in.
So even though we don't, so back in the day we had a glass blower in the department and he would have made you all this fancy stuff. Now you can just 3D print it.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Well, we're just about out of time. All the best for it. Maybe in a couple of years when we're all done and you've got all these amazing results, we could get you back. We'll find out how it all went.
Sounds like a plan.
Cool. But for the moment, thank you, Andrew, for coming along and telling us what you've been up to. And thank you, everyone out there, for listening.
You've been listening to the Science Notes podcast, brought to you by the Division of Sciences at the University of Otago. To listen again or to find other episodes in this series, go to Otago Access Radio's website, oar.org.nz, or to your favourite podcast platform.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.